Hi, I'm Ryan Ballingy, and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. It's good to have you here with us. You can connect with the show in a variety of ways. You can catch us on social media, on Facebook and Twitter, at facebook.com and twitter.com/golfnewsnet. You can catch us on our website, which is golfnewsnet.com. You can find us on the TuneIn radio app, where you can hear this show and 10 other shows from around the world, terrestrial radio to podcasts, in a format we call GNN Radio that has really resonated and is taking off quickly. You can find it at golfnewsnet.com/radio, or as we said, on the TuneIn radio app. And of course, you can follow me directly on Twitter, twitter.com/RyanBallingy, or email me your comments about the show or anything else, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. So it's been about a month since we did a podcast, and I don't even remember if we put the last podcast up on iTunes, so it may have been even longer than since we've done one, but we finally got into the heart of the summer. We've launched GNN Radio. Golf News Net's doing great, and some things have calmed down otherwise. And really wanted to get into a conversation tonight about golf participation. And I know we talked about it in the last couple of podcasts that we've done, and it's been a hot topic all year long in the golf industry. And really, it's been one for the last several years. It just really has risen to the forefront in 2014, really thanks in part to this Hack Golf initiative that was introduced at the PGA Merchandise Show in January in Orlando, and really got people talking within the industry as well as outside the industry, because the game's largest equipment manufacturer manufactured an opportunity to talk about it. And so the result has been a lot of publicity for golf. Unfortunately, the conversation has been centered around the negative. People are leaving the game, why they're leaving the game. And there has been some positive coverage, albeit perhaps skeptically or even cynically, about the potential potency of foot golf to bring in new people, not necessarily golfers, but new people, patrons, to golf facilities to bring them extra money. And there's been a slew of negative coverage kind of written not long form, but in longer form than maybe your typical blog post, trying to explain the woes of the game by kind of business related websites and media entities. Think CNBC and NBC News, which came out with a piece this past week. Think about Bloomberg. Think about Forbes. Think about Wall Street Journal. All of them have done major pieces, if not multiple pieces, in an attempt to explain what's happening in terms of golf participation. And to their detriment, all of them have failed to explain it or really do it any justice as to what's happening in the game of golf. And so the point of this podcast, in one sense, is kind of to be an episode of Mythbusters, where we kind of discuss what's being brought up in these pieces and then shoot them down. And then maybe we'll come back to the tail end of a piece I wrote for Golf News Net last week on the heels of Dick's Sporting Goods announcing they were firing some nearly 500 PGA of America professionals from their stores as they kind of retool what their golf presence is going to look like in their big sporting goods shops and their Golf Galaxy investment and their ownership in that. And we'll touch on that, because there has been a little bit of interesting backlash to the piece I wrote, the silver lining that it kind of put on this mass layoff of what is essentially 2% of the PGA of America's membership, the 27,000 men and women that they represent. But I want to save that for the end. So let's kind of delve into what the tenor of these pieces have been. And I'm not going to go out and name names of authors. I'm not trying to shame anybody, because I don't think that these authors are coming at it from a perspective of trying to hit the game hard and just beat a dead horse, because golf's not dead and they're not that sadistic. But I think what the issue is, and I'm guilty of this. I've done this as a writer before in the past, and I hate when I do it, especially when my mind changes. But you try to think about a piece, and you see a topic, and you get interested in it, and you go to your editor, and you say, I want to write about blah, 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 blah. And you usually, when you get the green light, you go into a piece thinking you're going to reach a certain conclusion, and that the data will take you there, because you've observed something in the world that just convinces you this is worth talking about, and this is the conclusion you're going to get to. And so often, when you do that, and you reach a conclusion before you get all the facts and all of the data in, you just kind of shed all of the data that doesn't support your position, or you stop looking once you find the data that does support it. And I will make an example of the NBC News piece, the CNBC piece in that regard, which its entire premise was that because Tiger Woods is no longer playing at the kind of torrid pace he did in 2000, basically through 2008, that golf participation declined as a result of his professional decline, that he doesn't want to major in 6 years, and therefore it's golf's problem to inherit that Woods isn't as good as he once was. And that's just a flawed notion. And then you have a Forbes piece that came out this week that was, frankly, even more laughable because it was a discussion about the golf industry failing to attract millennials to the game with notions that golf is an exclusive sport and that millennials are more inclusive of a generation than ever before and that they don't have the time to do this and they don't want to play golf and blah, 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 blah. And that they failed, the golf has failed to capitalize on junior golfers, and that's the reason for the slide. Okay, fine. And so those are the kind of two main themes that come up in these pieces, that we aren't getting young people and that there's a lot of massive golf course closures and that Tiger Woods isn't playing well. And I think we kind of have to break this down a little bit. And we talk about it a little bit in a piece also on golfnewsnet.com about why Tiger Woods really had nothing to do with golf participation, its boom, and since shedding of that group. And we look at numbers and we kind of put together three charts and tried to not make it such a long piece, so data heavy that was inaccessible for people to appreciate or understand. And we got some pushback on it from folks who said, well, of course Tiger had so much to do with participation because you can see in the chart, Tiger is a pro, participation goes up, and then it goes down again, and he's not playing well. So it has to be him, or at least a big influencing factor. And that's just simply not accurate because you kind of have to break down the numbers. So let's do that first. So over the course of Tiger's professional career from 1996 to the present, golf has seen a net loss of approximately 1 million golfers. But in that time span, in 1996, the National Golf Federation or Foundation measured or estimated that about 25.1 million golfers played, or there were 25.1 million golfers in the United States. And in the time span from 1996 to 2005, about 5 million people took up the sport. And 5 million people took up the sport in kind of this sudden fashion, where in 1998 to 1999, the golf population grew by approximately 2 million people. And then over the span of the next several years, another 3 million people came into the game. And you have to go, well, Tiger was kicking ass then, so certainly it really had to be him making the sport cool and people wanted to be like Tiger. And there's a problem with that. And the data, as you look at it more, can explain it. So first, let's talk about who makes up that 5 million people. So 3 million people of that 5 million are men. 2 million are women. Almost none of them, substantially in terms of net, were children, were people under 18. So let's take the junior piece first. Golf participation among juniors, among people who are minors, has basically gone untouched, plus or minus 100,000 people here and there, over 20 years. So whatever is happening at junior golf, whatever is causing that stagnation in terms of overall participation, has nothing to do with Tiger, good or bad. He just hasn't had the total net influence that you think he should, because when Tiger was cool for the first 10 years of his career, because he was so great, so dominant, and he was young and hip, well, hip, but he was that generational talent, and he really had no influence on junior golf. So basically a net zero in junior golfers, so obviously no influence there. Women who took up the game, there were some 2 million of them that took up the sport, really in the early 2000s, right before they hit the middle of the decade. And the reason women took up the game was because, A, they were interested in it, and B, they had money. Because in the early 2000s, after that initial recession post 9/11, the stock market recovered quickly. people's wallets recovered quickly, and then went above and beyond expectations right into an enormous real estate boom. So a lot of people felt they were sitting pretty and were able to take up the game, not only men who were playing, the additional 3 million men that started taking up the game, but another 2 million women who either wanted to play with their spouses or just had free cash and wanted to do it. So the strange thing about that is among the first people to leave the game when golf started to see its participation dip, and it started in 2007 and really accelerated in 08, 09, and has continued, that's really happened all women. I mean, 2 million people who left the game, the first 2 million, they're women. They were gone. They were out the door as soon as the Great Recession hit. They were done. And then in really the next 3 years, about 1 million people left, more or less a year, and those were basically all men. And that's just what the numbers tell us from the National Golf Foundation. So Tiger couldn't have had that big of an influence on the 2 million women that took up the game in the middle of the decade, because if you look at the demographics of who watches professional golf on TV or who even follows professional golf, I would be surprised if there were 2 million women that actually followed professional golf, much less cared about Tiger Woods in particular. So he had to have a net zero impact there. So at best, Woods can take credit for influencing 60% of the people that took up the game in that time span from 96 to 05. And then you just kind of look at the trends of golf participation growth and dip versus economic growth and dip and real estate growth and dip. Surprisingly, I thought that the trend was going to be with real estate prices. As it turns out, it's just simply with economic expansion. If you look at the trend line between how much the U.S. economy grows or does not, and how much golf participation reacts accordingly, it looks an awful lot like the same line. And there's a bit of a lag to it, about a 12 to 18 month lag between when people really start to feel the pinch of the economy in their wallets versus seeing it statistically take shape. So 12 to 18 months after the U.S. went to a recession, we really started to see people drop off. We saw about 500,000 people leave the game as soon as the recession began. I think that was probably more of a hint, anything else, of an impending doom. And more than anything, the recession accelerated people leaving the sport, or at least the replacement rate not being as high into the sport. And that's another issue with the participation numbers, is that we're talking about 5 million people leaving the game. It's not like we had a pool of 30 million people that all stayed the same for all of this time, and then 5 million of them raised their hands and I'm out, and went back to 25 million. No, it's not the case. Some really interesting folks at Northern Illinois University have kept track of this over the years, and they have a great archive. If you ever search Google for it, you can find the graphics and some really great reporting and archives of stuff from the National Golf Foundation in the early 90s, mid-90s. It's wonderful. But one really telling graphic, one telling chart that they have in their archive is a look at golf's demographics by five-year period. And it kind of cuts itself off in the mid-2000s. But the thing that you notice, and the thing that golf may have noticed but didn't realize it wasn't going to pan out as they anticipated, was that golf was getting older, and the percentage of people in certain age groups just simply shifted by age. So the same percentage makeup of people who were 35 to 40 then became 40 to 45, then 50 to 55, 60 to 65. So it was a generational move, and those were really avid golfers, people of a different era who could kiss their wife goodbye on a Saturday morning and come back Saturday night, play golf all day. Didn't have to worry about kids. They were handled. So as that generation got older, the problem really began to present itself, because you didn't see replacement rates of people who were in those prior age groups. And that's really the big story here, is that the baby boomer generation did not take to golf in the same way that it did the previous generation. That previous generation really loved their golf, and they still do because they're still alive. But they are much older. They're in their late 60s, 70s, 80s in some cases. That generation is starting to walk away from the game because they're getting older. They're retired. They lost money in several economic recessions and stock market dips. Dot-com bust, 90s bust, multiple real estate booms and busts. So the money that they have to live on is getting smaller as a result of our stupidity as a collective society and managing a boom-bust economy. So they're just walking away from the game. Or they're just too old. They don't want to play anymore. They don't feel like doing it. So they don't. And that creates an issue because they walk away from the game. And then you have this baby boomer generation that's enormous, some 70 million people that started really retiring in the mid-1990s and are going to keep retiring for another really 3, 4, 5 more years. And the anticipation in the golf industry was that when baby boomers retired, they were going to take up golf in the same way that their parents did. They would react exactly the same, and there would just be so many more of them that golf participation numbers would not only replace the people that were leaving the sport, but more than replace them, maybe double them, get up close toward 50 million people playing the sport of golf. I mean, there were crazy numbers being thrown out there as participation rates. And two groups of people responded to that. One, the golf industry responded to that, thinking this was a big cash cow and they could just kind of rest on their laurels and hit people again and again and again for $400 drivers and $1,000 sets of irons. And they would buy them. And this was going to be great for everybody. And that's kind of the calculation Dick's made with really unfortunate timing in 2007 when they brought in these PGA of America professionals. They thought the economy was going so great. Golf was a go-to sport. Baby boomers are going to take up the game in mass numbers. Here we go. Big cash cow. Easy, easy money. Just bring in these PGA of America professionals to get people to come out of those green grass shops at golf stores, come to us, kind of fight off the internet and showcasing a little bit, or storefront casing or whatever the hell it's called. And then all of a sudden you'd have hand-over-fist golf money coming in. And the truth is, baby boomers are facing a lot of things. But first of all, they are not like their parents. They don't just golf. They don't just go somewhere for 24 hours and then come back to their house. And they've got a bunch of other activities to do, including work. Because baby boomers, thanks to being the recipients of those same boom-bust problems as their parents, but earlier in life, they've had to kind of refocus and work longer. So they work longer, which means they have less free time. They have less money because they have less saved for retirement, and they also seem to have to take care of their children for longer because their kids aren't getting jobs out of college. So they took on college debt for their kids. They're housing their kids. They have enormous mortgages to pay off because they bought a big house and they might have refied it a couple times or pulled out some equity out of it so they can't sell their house. And that leaves them with very little disposable income to spend to the amount that their parents did on golf, much less kind of to the avid golfer level. So that's why avid golfers are leaving the game, because they're just playing less to a degree. And so that's kind of the baby boomer story. Golf made that calculation, but so did the real estate industry, which saw golf courses as a selling point for their developments. So they built golf courses, and they were the big driver of golf course development, particularly toward the tail end of the boom, for really the last 5 years of the boom. Most golf courses built in the United States were attached to some kind of real estate development. And the thought behind that was that those developers could charge some 30% more for the homes that were on golf courses or in golf course developments than were not. So they figured it was worth the risk. They would buy all of this land, develop most of it, put a golf course through it, charge 30% more. It would more than cover the cost of developing the golf course. They could still keep a piece of the course, owning it, or sell it to somebody else. They'd have someone come in and run it. They'd either get residuals off of a land lease or just make a profit when golf courses were hot property. And it worked for a while. People wanted to live on a golf course. They just didn't want to play the golf course, so many of them. That's why golf participation didn't skyrocket with the kind of extent to which it should have with the amount of golf courses that were built. I mean, in a basically 10-year stretch, about 1,500 golf courses popped up around the United States. That's an enormous hike. That's a really big hike. And if you think about the volume, the increase, just the sheer increase, it just didn't keep pace with, I said 1,500, I mean 4,500 golf courses open in the United States. That's a lot of golf courses. And if you think about where the number of golf courses were before the mid-90s, I mean, you're basically going from 12,000 facilities to 16,000 facilities. That's an increase of almost 40% in terms of the number of golf courses in this country. Over that same time period, the amount of people that played golf went up net 25%. So even if the Great Recession never happened, even if the boom and bust of the real estate economy didn't happen, there'd still be a correction in the number of golf courses in this country, because by percentage points, there's 15% more growth in the number of courses versus the number of golfers. So there would naturally have to have been a correction. And it turns out that correction seems to be happening most through the course of these last 5, 6, 7 years in courses where green fees are cheaper. So the high-end facilities, private clubs, they're doing fine. Maybe not great, but they're doing fine. The ones that are suffering are the clubs that are not public, they're not municipally owned, or even they are municipally owned. They charge a cheap amount of money for kind of minimalist golf, and that's not what people want when they play the game. Golf is, again, a luxury. It's not something you just play to play. And people have been conditioned, thanks to things like GolfNow, to shop for the cheapest rate. So we're all racing to the bottom in the industry, offering cutthroat prices for what used to be maybe $55 courses you can play for $28. Well, no shame on the consumer to do that, but the reality is that squeezes out those facilities that were meant to be charging $28. Now they're charging $19. It's almost impossible to run a decent golf course, not a high-end golf course, just a decent golf course, unless you're doing absurd volume. And then even if you're doing that absurd amount of volume, then it's a slow course and it's not always in great shape, and then people stop coming. So that's kind of the trickle-down effect of price wars on golf participation and the golf infrastructure. So all of that is to say that there are a lot of reasons why people aren't playing golf. The ones that are playing golf now, that are walk did play golf 10 years ago, that have walked away or are slowly walking away, net-net, is because a generation is aging and they're walking away from the sport and just not being replaced at the same rate by the baby boomers. And youth participation has absolutely nothing to do with this. But I will attack a couple of points in the Forbes piece. And the primary one that I think is hilarious is that it goes to say millennials are the most inclusive generation. They want to share their experiences with as many friends as possible. But golf says all of you can play as long as it's no more than four. I'm not buying that. Think about what social media is. I mean, think about Facebook. Think about Twitter. You have followers, but you get to dictate who's in your circle. You decide your circle by who you follow or who's your friend. And you can shut people out. In fact, you go out of your way to shut people out who don't want to see it. Your parents, sometimes your family, sometimes exes, sometimes people you just don't want to see you the details of your life. They're exclusive. They may be more diverse, but they are certainly exclusive. Nothing has changed in that regard. And so I guess I just kind of find that funny, that the Forbes folks who just couldn't seem to go with the Tiger Woods trope, which I applaud, they went with a different trope, that young people aren't taking up the game. Those damn millennials we're not getting to. I'm a millennial. I play golf, and my golf club has seen a resurgence in the last 12 months because it has offered zero initiation fee to get into the club, and then you spend a little bit each month, and all of a sudden you have a great opportunity to play golf and network. People see the value of golf membership. It's just not the same value that it once was. My golf club used to have a $15,000 initiation fee and a waiting list years deep to join it. That's changed because people spend their money differently, they spend it a little bit more diversely, and then frankly, they just have less of it. So that is really the explainer for golf participation's problem. It has nothing to do with Tiger Woods. It has everything to do with demographics. And primarily the demographics are not millennials. They are the baby boomers and their parents, and the different way that they seek leisure and the availability of money to spend on leisure is different for the both of them. And the result is 5 million people who took up the game, net 5 million walked away from the game. And I would be willing to wager that some half of that can be attributed to the replacement rate issue, and about half of that, mostly the women who walked away from the game as soon as the Great Recession hit, could be attributed to economic factors. And now we've kind of been in this stagnant economy for 4 years. We're still not at a point where we're kind of in an expansion. And when that next expansion comes, you'll see a nice jump in golf participation again. So we may be talking about this story for a while until the next great American boom comes, if we can engineer that as a country. But golf, its well-being is tied directly to the well-being of the United States as a country, as an economy, and primarily of the demographics of people who are older than 40. Nothing else matters to golf. Everything else is really just a bonus at that point. So with that all said, now we kind of have to think about knowing the causes of our problem. What do we do to address it now? And how do we deal with the long-term issue of the next generation, the ones after the boomers, who are replacing at a lower rate, if not a negative rate? And as Forbes accurately does say, they are more diverse. So there's two issues, longer term issues, than just kind of solving what's going on with baby boomers and their parents dying or walking away from the sport at old age. One, with millennials, there's the diversity issue. Let's face it, predominantly white people play golf. Just the truth of the matter. And that creates a problem for golf, at least as it's currently perceived and marketed, because white people, Caucasian people, do not make the overwhelming majority of the American population anymore. So that means there are less white people that can play golf, which means golf has to become an appealing sport not only to Caucasian people, but to African Americans, to Asians, to Latinos. And frankly, that's just not the case right now. We just haven't done a good enough job of that. And that is kind of the holy grail for the future. If you can make golf seem more inclusive by virtue of making it appealing to people of all backgrounds, all ethnicities, then you have something on your hands where you may be able to increase golf participation across the board. So that's one part of it. The other big challenge for the long term, not the baby boomer generation, but the millennial generation, is that they are the ones that instigated the urban revival of the United States. They're the ones that said, I'm tired of living in the suburbs and having to drive everywhere. I want to get the hell out of my parents' house and live in a city. And I want to be near everything. I want to be near it all. I want to be near shopping. I want to be near my supermarket. I want to be near my kids' school. I want to be near art galleries, entertainment, everything. I want it now. And so they moved into cities. And guess what isn't in cities? Well, very well. Golf. Golf's hard to find in cities. And even if you find golf in cities, it's usually on the outskirts of cities. And they're usually municipal courses. They're not upscale courses. So those are the first courses to close when the baby boomers and their parents started to leave the game of the Great Recession, leaving minimal golf infrastructure in the cities. And meanwhile, no person, no millennial, not many at least, want to hop into a subway or into a bus with a set of golf clubs and ride for an hour or two just to go play some golf. That just doesn't really happen. So the problem is how we're marketing golf in an urban environment is it's basically non-existent, especially in major markets. And then you look at where golf really is. It's in suburbs. Golf's in suburbs and exurbs. Well, they're becoming unpopular places to live. And they're also becoming places where affluent people aren't living. They're moving into cities. Affluent young people are moving into cities. Leaving suburbs is kind of the middle class areas of America. And that's what they kind of had been for most of their rise in popularity. And then they became an affluent area, and then that kind of started to shift. The money moved into cities. And so golf in the suburbs doesn't seem so appealing to folks who live in the city, who have money, and they don't really need the suburbs. So that leads into what we've been talking about on the website on golfnewsnet.com about participation and its tie to what happened at Dick's Sporting Goods a week ago, where 478 PGA of America professionals were handed pink slips and said, your services are no longer needed in our stores. And that kind of relates all to an opportunity that lies in front of the golf industry, is how we market golf to people. And I got called out by some guy who has a Blogspot site, and it was not a very intelligent take on his part. But my view is a little out of the box on what these firings mean and the opportunity that it presents for golf as a whole, capital G golf, to think about itself. And the takeaway for me is that we are marketing many golf facilities, not every golf facility, but many golf facilities the wrong way. And we're doing it because we're still thinking about it largely in a way that is two generations old. We're thinking about it of marketing to older folks, really older folks, the folks that are walking away from the sport because they were the bread and butter. We knew how to market to them. That's how we made money. We, capital G golf. And behaviors have changed, interests have changed, time availability, amount of wallet available have changed. And so to be able to get people, baby boomers and younger people, to a golf facility, you have to be more than just golf. Sounds crazy, but think about Topgolf. It's been the talk of the town in this past year, even though it's been around in this country for like 15 years. And it's finally getting the attention it deserves because it does something extremely well, two things extremely well. It handles the urban golf aspect of it because it's a driving range that can be put anywhere there's enough space. And second of all, it combines multiple aspects of fun that you otherwise really don't think about on the golf course. There's music, there's beer, there's friends, there's video. It's just all there in one spot, and you can stand there and just have a good time. You don't need to walk. You don't need to do anything different. You can just be immobile and have a lot of fun. And that model, that Topgolf concept that appeals to so many people, even people who have no idea how to golf because they just want to go have fun, and just having a golf club in their hand happens to be a side effect of that. I think that can apply to golf courses and golf properties. Now, again, not everyone, not your high-volume muni that is just pure golf and is awesome for that, not your high-end resort that thrives off of having minimal play and just kind of that luxurious experience where you pay at a premium. You're kind of looking at the upper middle tier of golf courses here that can do this, but I think that there's room to essentially make the golf facility a mixed-use facility, to use a real estate term, and create places where you can play golf that you can do a whole lot of other stuff. You can swim, play tennis, take a walk in the park, play with your kids, maybe have a spa day, maybe you can go to a golf course restaurant / bar that actually is appealing. It's not just a hot dog shack. It's not an afterthought. You can see a concert there. You could spend a day at the golf course, quote unquote, and do a whole lot of things other than golf. That's the kind of way that you attract young people with a lot of options to come to your place. Because you give them one spot that has a lot of choices, a lot of things to do, they're not going to get bored, and they're going to stick around. And for families where, again, I cannot go to my wife and say, I'll see you in 16 hours, I'm going to the golf course, even though I live right next to it. That, for people like me and my wife and my son, our golf club is a great opportunity because they can go swimming. I can go swimming with them. I can stop, go play 9 holes, come back. We can have dinner. We can have a putting contest together, hit the tennis ball back and forth, come back, call it a day. Great day. And that's what you need to be able to offer people at a golf facility, is the opportunity to do multiple things that attract your family that aren't just golf, because maybe your wife doesn't want to golf. Maybe your spouse doesn't golf. Maybe they want to spend time with the kids. Maybe they want you to spend time with the kids. And you need activities to do together with them, watch TV, look at phones, and all that kind of stuff. That's the opportunity before golf. That's the opportunity to use PGA of America professionals that are not just sweater folders. They are people who are trained to run businesses end to end. They just happen to be golf businesses. But they can adapt. They're smart people. They can learn how to run a multifaceted mixed-use golf facility that will give them multiple income streams, diversify the money that's coming in, and not leave them so subject to conditions that they really have no control over whatsoever. Meaning weather, first of all, then the economy, and then demographics. If you give people multiple things that could appeal to them, they're more likely to come. You're not so stuck on one driver of money. And if you're good at multiple things, like serving food, like having a bar, like having a spa, then you can do so much more as a business. You can grow quickly. You can reinvest in your business. You can reinvest in your golf course. You can hire people. You can do other things. And that's all a result of deciding to not make the only thing that comes, the only revenue that comes in your door, green fees and cart fees. It's a great opportunity, and I'd love to see someone try it. But I think there's also a natural cynicism from people who just believe it's always the way it's been done, and trying something different is stupid and it won't work. Well, if trying something stupid is, or trying something new is stupid and it's not going to work, then let's enjoy the next 10 years of golf course closures until we get back to a reasonable supply of golf courses. And we lose thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs in the golf industry on top of that. Fine. Maybe we'll lose another million golfers before we get it. Before we really get trying something different. Fine. If you're okay with that, I'm okay with that. But I'm not okay with that. And you neither should you. So, as an industry, we need to really do two things. We need to have innovative ideas. And that's why I don't deride the concept of hack golf. There needs to be innovative ideas. There just needs to be more buy-in from the entire industry. And second, we need to tell our story in a way that isn't defensive, but that is honest, transparent, humble, and comes with a message of inclusive outreach to people as a modernization of the sport for the 21st century and a new generation and a new United States of America. If we do that, then we have a better chance. If we work together, we have a better chance. If we do it in a way that has our hats in our hands, we have a better chance. I invite all your feedback. I'd love to hear from you. Email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Head over to golfnewsnet.com/radio. Listen to the show. Listen to our GNN radio product as well. I think you'll really love it. We have so many great shows airing on the network now, and four or five more to come in the next month or so. We're really proud of it, so we hope you'll give us a chance. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/RyanBellinger, or you can block me, as some people do. Or you can send me a critical comment and then block me. Whatever you feel like doing, that's fine. I just want to get the conversation going. Follow us at twitter.com and facebook.com/GolfNewsNet as well. Thanks for listening and really indulging me to talk about golf participation for about 35 minutes. We'll come back with another podcast soon where we won't necessarily talk about golf participation, but we'll certainly talk about the bigger issues in the game. And in the meantime, as we chomp on how we figure out getting more people into the game and stemming the tide of them leaving the sport, I'm Ryan Balaji saying thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.